the thing we least want people to know about us. When you let people see your genuine, authentic vulnerability, if we can lay things down, we lighten our load.
Hi, welcome to Resonate, Conversations and Life Lessons from Rancho La Puerta. I'm your host, Barry. My guest today is Catherine Trenshaw. Catherine is a founder and creative director of the Passionate Presence Center for Creative Expression. She is a UK-based international artist, art therapist, author, and recently a documentary filmmaker. Catherine calls herself a radical well-being facilitator. Her latest worldwide art project is called In Your Own Skin, which is a book, a series of portraits, and now a documentary film. Traveling the world, Catherine asked people, what is true of you but not obvious to others? What might be that thing that you're hiding from others but is true to who you really are? It's beautiful how vulnerable and authentic we humans can be. I'm looking forward to today's podcast. Good morning, Catherine. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Barry. I'm very excited to be here with you in your new recording
studio. This is the first time in our new studio, and I'm very excited. And you're my first in-person person, so that's awesome. So, Catherine, people might detect a little bit of an accent. Where's that coming from?
Well, I say this is a globish accent because I've lived in 5 countries. I live in England, and I've lived in England for 35 years. I was born in the States, but I also lived in the Netherlands for 2 years, and France for a couple of years, and Italy.
Wow.
So this is a confused and displaced wherever I go accent.
Well, it's great because no one really knows.
Guess Canadian.
Canadian?
Yeah.
Okay.
Which I like.
Yeah. I didn't even know Canadians had that much. Yeah, I guess they do have a bit of an accent. Yes. So you're an artist, therapist, and author.
Correct.
So how long have you been doing art?
Since I got a hold of the opposable thumb, basically. Mm. Okay. So that means early. I've always been an artist.
Right.
And I've been exhibiting since I was little selling my work since I was in high school. And so that's a very long time because I'm old.
Right. Not really. And now I think you have a title that you use for yourself as a radical well-being facilitator.
Correct. Which covers everything.
It does kind of cover a lot.
Yeah.
What does the word wellness mean to you? Because people use that word a lot. I'm always curious what they think about that word.
Well, I think what I love about the ranch, I have to say, it's kind of tending to all the different pillars of well-being and includes art. Mm-hmm. And I think that the work that I do as an artist and an art therapist and a writer and now a filmmaker, they're all kind of looking at how do we increase our deep authenticity, our well-being, our health, our nervous system, our immune system. All of that is aided tremendously by creativity and by authenticity. Right. So everything that I'm doing, somatic-based practice with creativity combo as an art therapist, is incorporated into my work. I do a lot of facilitating retreats and even corporate work so that I can help people think outside the box.
Yeah. Tell me what somatic therapy means.
Well, it could be as simple as movement practice, like 5 Rhythms or Nia or a lot of those things that are offered at the ranch. Any kind of movement practice, but also just movement for the sake of movement. Like, what does your body want to do today? So somatic experiencing, IFS work, internal family systems, which is another whole somatic modality. But 5 Rhythms, contact improv, all of those form the basis. Authentic movement. These have all been at the ranch and will come again. So all of those kind of body-based, getting in your body. If your body moves, then you can solve almost anything. And I think especially for mental health, it's really, really important. And again, as a foundation, you know, even just a simple hike in fresh air, but then getting into a studio on a good dance floor and being able to move and just follow your body.
Right. And you're an art therapist too. So how did you shift from, or did you shift from using art as an expression to using art as therapy and as a healing modality?
Yeah.
And you know, how did that change the way you looked at what you did?
Well, I've always been an artist. always. Mm-hmm. And so that was just something I took for granted, like eating and breathing and creating, you know, always. I mean, I took every book out of the library on creativity when I was a kid, and then I had to go to a bigger library. This was back when we used libraries.
Yes, yeah, I kind of remember. Yeah.
Vaguely. Mm-hmm. But then when I went to university and I studied to become a therapist, the mode, you know, the traditional talk therapy, what I found was that it was inadequate. It was great for telling the same story over and over and over. And it's still very useful and serves very well. But there is a tendency to keep telling the same story. Like you're sitting on the chair, you're telling the same story. Mm-hmm. And it's like trying to pick up the chair you're sitting on. It's quite difficult.
Right.
If you take it into your body, if you take it into mask making, if you take it into mark making, suddenly you can kind of see more clearly. It's like getting it from inside your body to outside your body.
Yeah.
So working with your body and also expressing from deeper in your body, not so much like from the neck up, but from the neck down. And what I found was that it was effective. Mm-hmm. And what I was really interested in was effectiveness. And so working, I did for 10 years, I really specialized in working with adult survivors of child sexual abuse. And talk therapy wasn't cutting it. Mm-hmm. And mask making was the thing. So I did this big project called Breaking the Silence that toured around the United States and Europe for 10 years. Mm-hmm. 100 masks. Mm-hmm. And teaching doctors and nurses and therapists and art therapists, you know, teaching people this modality that I created with mask making. Mm-hmm. And it was so effective. People in very much more efficiently could evolve and transform and heal. And I thought, that's interesting to me. So I kind of changed everything then. Because it was just what worked. It wasn't so much that it was clever. It was like, I wanted to actually not keep people forever as clients. Mm-hmm. I wanted people to heal. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And so that became my interest.
So is it kind of with mask making, is it kind of like you're able to like, I've read before, like, you know, when you study Buddhism and stuff, you are not your thoughts. So is it a way that you can take some of those feelings and emotions and transfer them to something outside of you?
Exactly.
Right. And there's a way to look at it separate from you.
Exactly. And go, and then have a dialogue, which ties back to the IFS work. I don't know if you've done any internal family systems work, but it's not so much that you're trying to get rid of things. You're trying to like go dialogue with them and go, okay, so this is part of me. Mm-hmm. It's not good or bad, but it's part of me. And how would you engage with this thing? Mm-hmm. So even if you create a mask, say, that's actually something that was quite negative, quite a negative experience. You make a mask of something horrible that you've been carrying around. You can go, well, actually, you've really served me well. Mm-hmm. You've done a good job, and thank you. And I don't need you anymore. Mm-hmm. And you know, maybe you do, maybe you don't. But you can find out if you do, and then you can do some simple ritual, like bury it in a box, or float it down a river, or put it in a tree so it can dissolve. You know, sounds simple, but honestly, very, very effective and remarkably moving for people. And similarly, you can make a mask. I don't know why the masks are easier to talk about. People really relate to faces, and I'm still on faces. Mm-hmm. If you want to make a mask of something that's your protection, your internal strength and protection and wonder and radiance, you can display that to remind yourself how amazing you are and how strong you are and how much genius you hold.
Right.
And it's just simple but effective. I like simple but effective.
No, yeah. I mean, I think it's things are really simple, but we make them complicated.
Well, I don't trust things that are too complicated.
Yeah.
And staying simple is not easy. I think there's a big difference between easy and simple. Because simple is like, you know, a good poet, to get down to the essence of things, that's where the work is. To say less takes more work.
No, that's I like that way you said that. Mm. Okay, no, we want to get to your latest project for sure, which is In Your Own Skin, right? And there's a book, there's a documentary.
There are giant portraits.
And giant portraits.
2 meter by 2 meter portraits, which are very cool because we love looking at faces. Again, kind of back to mass, we're monkeys. At the end of the day, we're part of nature.
Right.
And we really love looking at each other's faces. So they're very touching. To see them in that format, it's very cool.
And so this idea came to you at a silent retreat?
Correct.
Tell us about that.
Okay, well, I know it's not everybody's cup of tea, but again, just referring back to the rest, the silent dinner here is awesome. I try and do it every time I come. For 30 years, I've done a 2-week long silent retreat, which has changed my world. I mean, I'm very lucky to have this little international community that I meet with somewhere in the world and have this experience. But if you've ever done silence, you get very clear about what your demons are and about what matters, because you have you're not writing, you're not reading, you're not touching, no eye contact. Mm-hmm. It's really intense and very, very beautiful and clarifying. So I was on the silent retreat, and then I thought, well, I really wanted to come up with another good 10-year international project. I seem to like these. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to come up with a really juicy question for this film project. And I got it. It was, well, the realization came, the starting point was actually the thing we least want people to know about us, which often comes up in silence. This horrible thing that we're like, oh God, don't look at my vulnerability. It's awful. Actually, when you let people see your genuine, authentic vulnerability, they're like, but you're gorgeous now. You know, it's like you've lost 10 years. You've got younger since you've laid that thing down. Mm. All of these are ways of laying things down that we're carrying, that we think are heavy and that we have to hold in. Mm-hmm. When in fact, if we can lay them down, journaling is another way. If we can lay things down, we lighten our load. Mm-hmm. So I did that, you know, at my worst moment, I was really up against it. And I thought, okay, what if I just let everyone see how it really is? And it was like, oh my God, you're gorgeous. And I knew it was true. I knew this was not a place where people were going to lie to me. So then I realized that I could do this project. Mm-hmm. I don't know how they came together, but it was like, I could ask people the question, what's true of you, but not obvious to strangers. They don't have to go on silent retreat. They don't have to do this deep dive, but on a fundamental level, it elicits this authenticity in people and something gets lifted from everybody. And I've got some, you know, I can share some of the stories of what people have shared, but it's remarkably effective, even in a fairly short, like a 2-hour time with people sharing and diving into that inquiry with them. People are very hungry to be authentic as well.
So did you, you mentioned that during the silent retreat, you decided to release some things about yourself?
Yes.
So who did you release those things to? And you felt the immediate release?
Well, I got the so it was more to do with feeling like I had a migraine. I was snotty. I was like, just felt like shit because I was trying not to be awkward. Let's say awkward.
Okay.
You know, my version of awkward.
Okay.
You know, how we all have awkwardnesses, you know, we all have things. And I kind of was like, and you know, the facilitator was like, well, so what's wrong with awkward? What about including awkward? What about not only like tolerating it, but abiding in it? And eventually, what about loving awkward? Mm-hmm. That's very radical. Like, what if we love the things that we least want people to know about us? So I really kind of got that. Mm-hmm. And then I got the reflection once I genuinely, not pretending to embrace awkwardness, but actually embraced my awkwardness as part of like who I am. But then I realized, well, who's not awkward? Who doesn't have that? So I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, no, it does.
But it's like we make such a big thing. We make much of a muchness about things. And actually, who can't relate with that?
Right.
And then what happened is everybody around me reflected back to me how I looked more beautiful and alive and vibrant. And it's like, oh my God, all I had to do was stop pretending to not be awkward.
Right.
Or not resisting this admission of humanity.
You also mentioned you said people are more being more authentic, but you've also used the word vulnerable.
Yes.
So do you think someone has to be vulnerable to be authentic?
I do. Actually.
Yeah, I think they kind of go together.
They definitely go together, and it's again part of well-being. Mm-hmm. If we can find a way. And I think they're almost interchangeable because I think vulnerability is inherent in authenticity. Authenticity is a more palatable word for people because it sounds cooler.
You're right.
But actually, you know, the Brené Brown research around vulnerability basically shows us that the more vulnerable we are, the more beautiful we become. And it's not logical, but it is verifiable.
Right.
I love that. And I saw that hundreds and hundreds of times with everybody that I met over these 12 years who participated in the In Your Own Skin project, which I know we're going to talk about and we haven't yet. But I just find people amazing. I found that with clients. I found that with the work that I do personally as well as professionally. Right. And that's the other thing. I don't ever offer anything to anybody that I haven't personally done and worked quite extensively before I bring it to them. So I felt very confident taking this question to elicit authenticity in others because I had explored it for decades myself. Right. So it was like, okay, I think this is a good question. And everybody I say the question to, the question that I ask everybody is, what's true of you but not obvious to strangers, again? And everyone goes, oh, that's a great question. Because you can answer it over a dinner table with strangers or with your family and friends. Right. You know, it's kind of relatable. And you can be as skinless or not as you want. You don't have to, it doesn't have to be about TMI. It can just be, well, I'm an odd sock wearer. You know, I never wear two socks that are the same. And that's kind of fun.
Yeah.
But it could also be, I'm going to die in 6 months. You know, and that's maybe not casual dinner conversation, but it's something that might be really interesting and change the tone and the tenor of that conversation.
Right. Okay, so you silent retreat.
You keep this, going back.
No, this question came up to you.
Yeah.
How did this question turn into a 12-year global project?
Well, first of all, it wasn't supposed to take 12 years.
Okay.
But it did. I did intend for it to be a big, juicy international project because I had done one before and I thought, well, I still got some life in me. I'd like to do another really big project. It seems to suit me. I half jokingly say that I'm a peripatetic social anthropologist because I like to do these traveling international things where I'm working as a radical well-being facilitator. So I thought this question, I wanted to arrive at a question for the film that could carry me into that future, into that 10-year mark. But I thought that would be, the whole project would be done in 10 years. Instead, the filmmaking has taken me 12 years. So the film took 12 years just to finish because, first of all, traveling around the United States, self-funding the film was a big thing, but also...
And it wasn't just the United States.
No,
it was like, how many countries, like 35 countries?
35 countries are represented. Yeah. And when I did the film, I mean, I've done about 350 portraits, but about 250 are in the film. And people say, well, how did you choose your countries? Well, I was biased because I do speak French fluently. So that meant like... Senegal, Morocco, France, Belgium, there were certain countries that were easier for me to not have to hire translators. But then I also had to take crew and cameras and have all the equipment with me. And so I kind of tied it around places that I wanted to go and also places that I thought would be very beautiful and interesting. So that took time. And energy. And luckily, my son was roped into that. He's a very, very good filmmaker and cameraman himself. So he got to come on the road with me a little bit begrudgingly, not a very good follower of directions, which he would admit, but awesome at attention to details. And that was fantastic, along with, you know, adult crew. And it really took time. But then I also had to face my own deeper vulnerability while I was making the film. I thought I was going to share, and people, whenever they ask me, I would tell them what my word was, what was my portrait going to say, which I would do. But then I also had to deal with my own big health crisis while I was making the film. And I thought, oh God, this is so annoying. I really want to finish the film, but I have to not die first.
Right.
That kind of created a little bit of time necessary.
How far into the project did that happen?
That's a good question. It was a couple of years, like 2 years in.
Okay.
And then I found myself having to go to a hospital somewhere in the world to get some private treatment. And I, this is fun. I always wanted to go to Day of the Dead in Mexico. And here I was facing my mortality. And I had to, I found a really good hospital not far from the ranch. And so I went there and I, for the first time on my bucket list, right at the top of my bucket list, I got to go to Day of the Dead in Tecate and at the ranch. And that was really great.
Right.
Like, oh, this is fantastic. Right. It's not exactly the way that I wanted to see this celebration, but I really loved it. It was very fun.
So when did the title emerge, In Your Own Skin? When did that become the name of this project?
That was from the beginning when I was developing the project idea and the question. I had to come up with a really juicy title to create branding around and also something that I could live with for a long time. Because In Your Own Skin is kind of eliciting that same idea. What are we deep inside? What are the hidden treasures that lie inside of our skin? Not so much who we say we are and what we say we do, which is, depending on the culture that you live in, more or less important. In the United States, it's very important that people say what they do.
Right, yes.
As opposed to who they are. And no blame, no shame. It's just like...
It's how it is.
It's how it is. And I know that inside of myself, and it's been mitigated tremendously by living in Europe. And I find, you know, I'll never forget, I asked a guy a long time ago, this is when I first moved to England, I said, you know, what do you aspire to? And he just simply said, with all seriousness, very calmly said, I just want to be at peace. And it like flummoxed me because I was like, oh, you mean you're not going to talk about the career desires that you hold?
Right.
He really, and it was true. It wasn't like it was made up or put on. He really just, and I was like, wow, I got to upgrade my goals.
You know what I mean? No, that is amazing. Like, that's amazing.
It was, it was really amazing. And I, and it has shaped me living in many countries has also changed my perspective. Because when you do live in many countries, you look back at your own and you go, huh, interesting monkeys. You know, and then from the United States, I look at England and I go, oh, yeah, interesting monkeys over there, too. Like, we're all Jane Goodall looking at the monkeys and going, aren't they charming?
Right.
And being curious about them rather than judging.
Yeah.
So it has also been helpful in doing project like this to have lived in many countries.
But the title, In Your Own Skin, that the skin, because you actually paint on people's skin.
Very
right?
good point. Yes. So I meet people. Mostly strangers. In the beginning, I did it with people that I knew, but not very well. I asked them if they're interested in this question. And if they say yes, then we spend a few hours together generally, and which is a combination of helping them arrive at the most interesting thing. Usually people say something quite obvious in the beginning. And it's like, yeah. Anybody could say that about you, you know. Like if it was you, Barry, they might they'd say you were charming, you were handsome. They probably guess you were wealthy.
All obvious.
They're you're well dressed, you know. But they would never guess this thing, you know. And so when I give people, I kind of phrase it like that. I say, if you're in the underground in London or the subway in New York, you're walking through. People will make assumptions, some of which will be totally wrong. Some will be right, but they'd never guess this thing. So it intrigues people. And then I write in face paint on their skin somewhere of their choice. Again, I don't accost people. It's not a 10-minute thing. It's a couple of hours. And then they choose where they'd like it written on their skin. And often where they choose to write it on their skin is quite poignant as well.
Yeah,
sometimes it's on their face. Sometimes it's on their cleavage. Sometimes it's on their hand. Sometimes it's tiny. Sometimes it's huge. The trick is just having few enough words. So again, it's like a one word or short phrase that is the essence. And that essence is almost more like a poem because you get down to the nub of what is the thing.
Right.
So again, we're going for the essence, the most simple, the most poetic version of whatever it is. And it's written on people's skin, which is intriguing, but it's also as if it rises up through their skin to the surface.
Right.
So we have kind of both. And people who've been seeing the film have said, oh, it's both ways. They're also becoming art. By writing it on their skin, becoming an oeuvre, becoming a sculpture. And for some people, when they do it, they're laying something down that changes them. So there's a, I'll give you an example. It's probably easier. So there's a docent. I don't know if she still comes to the ranch. I love her very much. And she has violent nightmares, not just nightmares like you and me, but like seriously a problem. And she has to have, she's from Texas, everything has to be locked up, the guns have to be locked up, and everyone else in the house has to know this could happen. She never knows when it's going to happen. She'll wake up and she needs protection, you know, and it was really a problem. And she was a bit ashamed, you know, that this happened. It wasn't, there was nothing she could do about it, but there it was. So she wrote, have nightmares on her cleavage. And then I saw her the next year at the ranch, and she said, you know, Catherine, ever since I've done that portrait, I've not had any more nightmares. And I'm not saying the film cured her of that. Mm-hmm. But I think there is something about owning and being liberated by yourself, mm-hmm. to yourself, that can be very effective. And so some people take it.
Yeah.
Some people go deeper than others.
Yeah, it's kind of like
risk more.
It's kind of like your mask project.
It is. I know.
Like
I'm just seeing
the mask, and then when you put it on you, you put it out to everyone, and maybe it releases you.
I hope you're enjoying today's podcast as much as I am. To learn more about our wonderful presenters and exciting weeks coming up at the ranch, go to rancholaporta.com and check out our events calendar. Make sure to mention the podcast when making your reservation to take advantage of a special offer. Some restrictions may apply.
So you show
up. And everybody else goes, oh, I can so relate to that.
Yeah, no.
It doesn't matter what people write, people can relate.
I mean, this human experience is so similar for so many of us. Yeah. And we always focus on why we're not the same, but we are so much the same.
We are so much the same. And we are a multitude. Like, not only are we a multitude as people, but we're a multitude within ourselves.
Right.
So, you know, it's really fun because Krista Tippett's here this week and I love her. Mm-hmm. And she's talking about how if you assert one thing, you have to assert the opposite. That's the principle of quantum mm-hmm. physics. And first of all, my mom read quantum physics for leisure when I was little.
Wow.
I did not have a normal mom.
Yeah.
And my son works in the field of quantum physics, and I love quantum physics. Not the math. Don't let me do math. Yeah. But the principles and the spiritual end of quantum physics. And so in the film, I talk about how you have to embrace the full spectrum to live a wholehearted life. You know, you have to, like, we all want the good, the bad, the bigger, better, faster, more. But then there's also the grief and the shame and the sadness and the pain that are important. And if you want a whole life, you got to have both.
Right.
But if you also take that curve and connect the two ends, you get an Möbius strip.
Yeah,
and it's continuous. And so it goes. And that's how we are. That's liberation.
Yeah.
And that's how we liberate each other.
Right.
And I feel like I couldn't be happier than to bring that information through the lens of all these different people sharing so generously their authenticity, you know, and we do. We love them all. By the end, you're just like, I'm in love with all these people.
What you just said made me think about the quantum physics of how you embrace one thing, the opposite you embrace too.
Yes.
Which is like living a full life and also dying.
Yes.
They're the opposites.
100%.
But like, you know.
You know, if you want to live really fully you need to remember you're going to die.
Yeah.
The Tibetans have this great tradition. Mm. 7 times a day, they chime a singing bowl. And every time that bowl chimes, you take a moment to be silent and remember you're going to die so that you live more fully.
So you live more fully. I love that.
Yeah.
Okay, so now let's go. You show up in a country.
Yep.
How do you find people that you want to talk to? Do people think you're this crazy person?
Don't tell me they think I'm crazy. They might without telling me. But some countries are easier than others.
Okay.
Let's say that. But like when I went to New York City, I know that's in the United States and I speak English, but sort of. Mm-hmm. But people said, no one's going to talk to you in New York. They're busy. You know, people don't have time for that. They're, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I actually went to Central Park and had a queue of people. I couldn't interview everybody. There was so much interest. Mm-hmm. When I went to Morocco, kind of the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
It was relatively easy to interview men, but women, guess what?
Mm.
They needed to have their brothers, their uncles, their fathers say it was okay. And the 10 women I had thought I had arranged to meet with, none of them could get permission.
Mm-hmm.
So then it was like I had a whole camera crew in Morocco and no one to interview. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to interview some women.
Except men.
Yeah. And I did interview some women in Morocco, but they were foreigners living there. They were easier. So finally, I found this amazing filmmaker who agreed to meet with me. She was young. And oh my God, Dalal. She basically wrote, I'm just a sexual object, and spoke about what it was like living in Morocco as a young woman and how it was tricky to be a part of a place she loved dearly, but felt the oppression of that every day. And to speak that, not only is she relatable, because any woman understands that, but also we had to explain to the younger members of the camera crew that she risked her life to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was in a public place. We were in a cafe, this beautiful cafe, but she actually put herself in some danger to do that. And they, at first, they were like, oh, you're just being a drama queen. It's like, no, no. We went back to the hotel. We said, we'll talk about this later. You know, like, we had to like go somewhere private and explain to them. And it was very schooling for them. It was really educational to go, oh my gosh, people live in countries still, women live in countries still where they can't just speak freely. And it was, again, for me as a mom, I thought this is the best school I could offer my son. This is the best education.
So if you're in Central Park, what, do you have a sign? How do people know? Or do you just...
I just walked up to people.
Just walked up to people.
Said,
you find someone who looks interesting.
You look interesting, and this is what I'm doing, and this is the question. Would you be willing to spend a little bit of time with me doing this? And usually, like there, it was particularly fun because I found these breakdancers who were super hot, I'm just saying, and they were interested in participating, and they were doing these impossible kind of jumping over. So I started interviewing one of them, and then they all wanted. They loved what I was doing. I think they also were scoping me out to see if I was trustable. And if I was without judgment. And then when I didn't kind of judge anything, then they were hungry to do it. And there's a guy in Central Park as well who I actually probably love one of the most. He was quite subtle. He's got a big turban. He's missing teeth. And I think he's without a home. And he holds up a sign that just says, I'm everyone. And it's like deep.
It's very profound.
And he's the kind of guy you wouldn't necessarily go up to and hang out with. And yet he offered one of the most profound moments in the film. And one of the best portraits. I mean, it's hard. They're all my babies. You know, I love every single person I interview. But some encapsulate something more holistic like that. We judge. You know, and that was the thing. I purposefully also interviewed people I wouldn't normally want to hang out with. Because I thought, well, what will they say? And sometimes it was like, oh, I'm so glad I did that. Because I just, you never know. There's hidden treasures in all of us. And it really does reinstate your faith in humanity. And people say that over and over, that it reinstates their faith in humanity. So I thought, who doesn't need that right now?
We all need that for sure, every day. So did you start with making the book and then decide to make a documentary after that?
I'm an ambitious person, and I'm very prolific in my artistic life. So I always envisage it as four things: the book, the film, the portraits, these giant portraits, and workshopping it in communities. It was the vision. So I wrote a whole plan from the beginning, came up with the title, came up with the logo, and like wrote, you know, I did, I used it like a business plan because I know I needed the structure. The thing about being an artist is like, you can do anything. So I needed the limits of my structure, which isn't very limiting, is it? Like going around the world and doing four different parts. But that's what I wanted to do. I wanted a really big, juicy international project. So, and I've never looked back. I mean, it's my meditation teacher also helped me a great deal, give me feedback. And it really, I wanted it to be a reflection of that depth of presence that I seek in my own personal practice as a meditator and as a movement practitioner. And so I wanted to offer something that was in keeping with that as well, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it totally makes sense.
So it's like a love letter to humanity, really. Yeah. I want to, you know, offer something really big and juicy before I die.
Right.
Another big, juicy thing that can serve in some way. And this seemed like the best answer to that question.
Yeah, well, I mean, I watched the documentary yesterday, and, you know, it's very moving.
Yeah.
Even if there were no words, it would be super moving.
Yeah.
So tell me one of the favorite people that I'm sure it's not fair to say favorite, but some interesting people.
We do have some favorites.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think you'll agree that the guy who is Paradox, that is his name, his legal name now. I think he changed it at some point, but there is a guy named Paradox who's a one-legged existentialist stand-up poet. And he was recommended to me as somebody to interview. He lives in London, and he's extraordinary as a performer. And he, funnily enough, was traveling in Mexico, and he followed some kids where they were jumping in the river, and he jumped in and he lost his leg. And he talks about the experience as obviously one of the most horrible things that could happen to a young man. He was in some kind of a traveling horseback circus acting. And he ended up, you know, having one leg, and he had this really cool Teflon black, amazing high-tech prosthetic leg that he would often walk around in shorts in London, and kids would come up to him and go, "What's that?" You know, he'd right. always give them the time of day. But he said, you know, "This is the worst thing that ever happened to me, and also the best. It healed his life. It healed his family. It healed his psyche. He had to really face his own mortality, obviously, because he nearly died. But in addition to that, he had to face his vulnerability. And because he couldn't hide it, I mean, he actually can. He does dance, and he is this amazing performer. He dances in the film, and he walks around. And you think, oh, he's got an interesting gait, but you wouldn't guess he's got a prosthetic leg until he shows us his prosthetic leg. But he's got this fabulous sense of humor and perspective, and he's very inspiring because it's like he's having a great time, and he has no regrets whatsoever. And he's very... I don't know. It's like he's made it into not his identity so much, but it really has shifted his whole perspective in life. And
what did he write on himself?
Oh, he wrote Gift.
Gift.
It's a gift.
It was a gift.
Yeah. And it was interesting because he's the only person, you know, I'm always asking, where would you like me to write it? Where on your skin would you like me to write it? But he had me write it on the prosthetic leg, the black prosthetic leg.
Because that was the gift.
That was the gift. And, and to him, and this is another cool thing, I don't know if you know this, you probably do, 80% of people who lose a limb still think they it's have there. Feeling. Yeah. And so for him, it was still his leg, you know, and that's interesting as well because he, it was, he got more and more modern legs as time went on and cooler feet.
Right.
And, you know, he had the shoe collection that worked with his prosthetic leg. And it was this whole world that I got to hear about and learn about. And it's very inspiring.
So the over 300 people, 35 countries, is there anything that common themes that come up? Is there something that's so universal that you see it everywhere?
Well, I think the I Am Everyone is a good example. You know, the fact that, like, there's a woman who wrote cocaine. And you think, well, I've never done cocaine. I don't do drugs. Or maybe you, but do you drink coffee? Do you have a glass of wine now and again? And what she said is, wasn't that she's addicted to cocaine. Not at all. She did it once. She loved it. She didn't want to keep using. But she wanted the feeling. She wanted the spiritual practice feeling that... She wanted to find a spiritual practice to get that feeling instead of doing cocaine. And it's like really touching. And it's not what you expect. Even when you see the portrait, you think, oh, she's addicted to cocaine. That wasn't it. It was just that she wanted to feel that love and that wholeness and oneness for the rest of her life. And so that was her aspiration, was to find a practice and to practice a practice long enough so she could feel that again.
Right.
So I don't think there's one. I think it's more like, and this is the tricky thing, when I show the image for In Your Own Skin, I have to almost show a collage of images.
Right.
Because there's no one person.
Right.
If you saw one person, you think, oh, that's about X.
Right.
But actually, it's about Y, and it's about Z, and it's about all these different things. So it is almost by definition a collage or a quilt or weaving of humanity.
Right. And I wonder if, like, you went back and interviewed some of those people again.
Oh, they have totally different answers.
Totally different answers, right? Because it's in the moment.
That's right.
It's in the moment.
That's right.
And we're always evolving and changing.
Yours would be different now.
Sure. And I think it's interesting, like the lady, you mentioned the lady, the cocaine, she's looking for that feeling.
Yeah.
That feeling that we're all looking for.
Yeah.
And we're all asking questions and we all want answers and
we're seeking.
Yeah. It's seeking. That's what it really is, right?
Yeah.
So what do you hope someone who participates in your program in any way, like buys the book, looks at the portraits, sees a documentary. What do you hope they go away with?
Well, I think it helps people remember that we see each other through the state of our nervous system.
Mm-hmm.
So what we project, how kind we are, how free we are, will dictate how kind and free that person we see is in our minds. And so there's something about my wish is that we liberate each other, actually. Like, no small wish.
But yeah,
I like to think big. I like
of
to
course.
Think big. And I really mean that. Like, can we be more kind today? Can we be less judgmental?
Mm-hmm.
Can we presume when that grumpy person on the road who cut us off, we could presume they're having a really bad day rather than think they're a bastard? You know,
right.
And it's such a small thing, but our nervous system benefits. I mean,
yeah, no.
Never mind them. But I really think that's quite a profound thing to remember, that our nervous system dictates what we see and what we experience around mm-hmm. us. And we can be a force of calm and presence and really hold that wholehearted life, which includes, yes, we can celebrate and have all the fun things above the curve, but also deal with our shame and our grief and our sadness and our pain, but not make it our identity, because it's all, it's a whole thing, you know?
So,
Sometimes I'm living in tremendous, tremendous pain, but it's not who I am. It's just this pain is happening, and I'm alive, and I'm whole and happy, and it's all of it, you know?
Right.
So I think it's a reminder for people that we're all connected. I think a lot of people have reflected, you know, the guests at the ranch, you know, this is like an exclusive situation where only the guests at the ranch get to see the film so far because I'm submitting to film festivals. And people have said, I really am reexamining my projection, the level of projection that I've held against people who are without a home, or against people who are poorer than me, or against people who are from another culture. It's like, I'm really reexamining that and going, wow, you know, really pausing. And another woman said, you know, she works for a giant Fortune 500 company. And she said, I've used your question ever since I saw your film. She came 2 years ago when it was in process. And she said, I've used it for every training, for every new employee at my giant company, because it's so helpful to just let people be more authentic. Right. So I love that. Like both ends of the spectrum, like daily mundane life and also corporate world. Like anything that I can do to infiltrate and sow seeds of kindness in that way.
Yeah.
I'm really happy with that. And also being art, like we are art. The food we eat is art. The activities we participate in are art. The atmosphere we surround ourselves with, the clothes we wear, like they matter and they impact us. And so can we just take a little bit more care around those things? I think it's quite, I mean, I know I'm a fan of art, but I think everything can be art. Our lives can be art.
No, I agree.
Yeah.
So you mentioned you're going to submit to film festivals.
Yes.
What else is the future of this project?
Yeah. Well, getting a second book out. I mean, the first book is great, and I want to do a much. There are more, so many more portraits. I even got to do the Kumeyaay Native American elder at the ranch.
Right.
So she's the only one who speaks Kumeyaay on a portrait so far. She's one of 30 people in the world, so I feel very privileged. So I'm still doing a few. I tried to stop doing portraits, but it's too addicting, I have to say.
Yeah.
But so what I'm doing is I'm promoting the book. I'm still fundraising to get the film finished and out there and into film festivals. I'm looking for people who want to be part of it. So people are joining the mailing list, and I'm submitting to film festivals and scheduling exhibits and events. So screening events, like fundraising events around the country. And there's a lot of interest right now in the Pacific Northwest and Washington, D.C. So kind of both of the Washingtons are really up for grabs. So I'm going to be scheduling some events, like visiting book clubs and doing screening events in different clusters around the United States, and really looking for endorsements as well from people who've seen the film and saying, this is fabulous, and this is why. And I've got a lot of those, which, you know, were in the press kit that I gave you, that people, even at the ranch, are just saying. There was a woman who came the other day, Alexa, she's a therapist, and she said, everyone in the world has to see this. So, yes, that's great.
Yeah, no, it is.
I agree.
It's great. So at some point, I could see this being like a workshop format, too.
Yeah. Totally. 100%.
So that's awesome. So
because the content, you know, there's there's the portraits and there's the inspiration from all the people who do the portraits. But then there's like the 40 years of work that I've developed that's encapsulated in it. I wasn't originally supposed to be in the film quite so much, but then I ended up having to be in the film. It sort of, there was this health crisis that ended up needing to be included, and then that meant I had to change the story arc, and I think the film really benefits from that being in it. I have to admit.
No,
my editor was like, you don't have a choice. I'm like, oh, I don't want to be in it so much. He's like, no, you really have to share this.
No, it helps to tell the story.
It does.
Yeah, it does.
Because I need to be very vulnerable too.
So that brings me to my last question. So today, right now,
yes,
if someone asked you that question,
oh,
what would your answer be in this moment?
Gosh. I would say, I mean, there's one, I'm not sure, we'll think, but one thing is I can say that there are three things trying to kill me, and I'm really happy to be here Yeah. I've never been more whole. That's too long-winded. But if I could work on that.
You could write it on both legs.
Yeah. No, but you know, like it's like somehow like, and these, you know, and this, it's like both. It's like the.
No. I also love that you use the word and
yes.
instead of but.
Yes.
I'm a big fan of that.
I'm a big fan of both and. And it is, it's true. I think that I've never been more whole and healthy.
Mm-hmm.
And in a funny way, like it, that's shorter. That could seem obvious, but if you knew my backstory, you'd be holy cow.
Yeah, how right. can you say exactly. That?
Because I was just having had so many health issues. But also, there's such a difference. And I love saying this to people. Death is not failure.
I love that. Heard
and
you say
death
that.
Death isn't like unwell. It's right. like you can be very healthy and very well in your deathing. And I'm a big fan of helping people to embrace death as part of life. That has always been something that I've been into, that my parents were into. We were taught young to appreciate the preciousness of life. But I've got it in spades now and really incorporating it much more into my work. And I love talking to people who are like in their 80s and they're like, yeah, I'm probably going to die sometime. It's like, you probably are and should possibly consider that it's something worth embracing and celebrating.
Spending some time thinking about that. Yeah. So for now, people can't see the documentary unless they're here at the ranch.
That's true. But they can see the trailer.
They can see the trailer.
And they can join the page.
And they can get the book,
that's right?
And are the portraits something that is displayed in different... It's, you know, you wouldn't see the portraits unless you go to an event.
Yeah, so that would be like museums that are hosting it. Or events. Sometimes the screening events will have the portraits hanging.
Right, okay.
So that is in the future as well. So it's organizing museums or civic centers or communities that decide. The nice thing about the portraits is they can hang indoors or outdoors, so they look really cool hanging on the outside of buildings or hanging down in a high ceiling structure. They're very beautiful. It's been fun because there's something about seeing a face that huge that really touches us.
Sure.
And if you look at the webpage, you'll see the portraits installed in situ. So it's really kind of fun to see humans next to the portraits and go, oh my gosh, the humans are tiny compared to those faces.
Right.
Yeah. So there's a lot of background material there and people can get involved if they want to as well, but also just, you know, check it out, see the trailer, buy the book. I always encourage people to buy the book maybe from their independent bookshops if they can, because we like to support independent bookshops and keep them alive. And join us.
Yeah.
Join us. And not, you know, if you want me to come and do a screening party and a workshop in your community, I'm game.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. It's really exciting. It's funny. That's another thing that Krista said when she's like wound down her podcast because she wants to do more things live. I like doing things live. That's why I like doing what I do at the ranch when I show the film and then I have the exchange and the interaction and the reciprocity and the Q&A. It's my favorite part, but I also think it's the people who come to the ranch. I think it's one of the things they love the most. They get to do things that are exclusive, but they also get to do things that are so special that they might not ever have the chance to do back home. And like, it's just here, just in the library lounge in this intimate setting with this fabulous sound system.
It's all about it's what your project's about. It's a human connection.
Yeah, human connection.
A human connection. Thanks for spending this time with me today. I really enjoyed it, and we need more inspiring people like you on this planet.
Thank
I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
I found Catherine's passion for using art to lift people up, to help them better understand themselves and others, to be inspiring. Though during the podcast, we only talked about one of the over 300 people she interviewed and photographed for this project, they all had amazing stories. They were all willing to share and be vulnerable. This really lifts the human spirit. It reminds us that what we may see or assume about a person is not the whole story. We're all different, and yet we're all the same. We share a lot of the same feelings and emotions. It also reminded me that it's not what happens to you, but what you choose to do with it that makes all the difference in the world. Until next episode, this is Barry wishing you health and daily joy.